Welcome back to the South Harbor Church Podcast. South Harbor is a part of the Harbor Churches, which exist to help people find their way back to God. This week, Pastor Jeremy brings us a message where we look at how Jesus leverages the space around the table. As always, for more information about how you can become a part of the South Harbor Church community, stick around after the message. And now, let's head over to Pastor Jeremy.
So good morning, South Harbor. My name is Jeremy, one of the pastors here. And how's everybody's brackets doing so far? We doing okay? Anybody like you're crushing the early rounds and now you're regretting the dark horse that you have picking it, like taking it all, right? I hope things are going well. We get to do some fun this morning. We're going to dive into a story. If you're new with us, we've been working through the book of Mark over the last handful of weeks. And we've been kind of looking at Mark is an author who wrote what we call a gospel. Gospel means good news. He wrote an account of the good news of Jesus. We have four of them. Mark wrote one of them. And so we've been stepping back and asking the question, like, what does Mark want us to know? When Mark is trying to put like Jesus on display, what are the things that Mark wants to make sure we catch? And this morning, we have the opportunity, we're going to look at a story. It's one of the stories that when we look at the Gospels, we've got four Gospels. We have Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, and kind of as we look in the New Testament, there are a few sentences that are written where we're told that like, this is the reason Jesus came. And now sometimes when the authors, when Matthew, Mark, Luke, John will talk about Jesus, occasionally they'll use some kind of like Old Testament language or some titles. And so on these, often what they say is that there's a sentence that starts, the Son of Man came, ... Four times in our New Testament, an author, Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, is going to say the Son of Man, Jesus, came to do something. Now, I want to try to play like, if you're like the Bible trivia ringer, can anybody complete the sentence? The Son of Man came to seek and save the lost. That's probably the most common one. It's what I guessed was the most common one. It's the one I put on the slide first. The Son of Man came to seek and save the lost. We see Jesus doing it all over the place. Jesus is constantly going to the people that his religious establishment has said were on the outside. Last week, we looked at an entire sermon where we went back to one of the Old Testament laws from the Torah that identified three types of people who are to be cast out. They are not like one, they are not one of you. They are to be outside of camp. And we looked at how Jesus went to each one of them and restored and redeemed them and brought them back in. Jesus seeks and saves the lost. We see it and do it all the time. That's one. The Son of Man came. Any others? One of them's a little tricky because it kind of starts with a not. It's what I think is maybe the second most popular is this one. The Son of Man came, did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. We see Jesus doing it all the time. Jesus did not come to sit on a throne, to have people bow and serve him. Jesus, from his birth, came into the most humble and lowly of circumstances. Jesus gave his life to serve anyone and everyone around him. We see Jesus doing it all the time. Son of Man came to... The third one I would say is a little tricky. It's John, who writes our Gospel of John, also wrote some letters. And in his first letter, what we call 1 John, John says this, says the reason the Son of God appeared was to destroy the devil's work. Jesus will say that the thief comes to lie, steal, and destroy. But Jesus says, I have come to give you life and to give it to the full. That what we see is Jesus constantly speaking truth into the face of the lies, that Jesus came to undo all of the broken things in the world and make those things right. A last one, the Son of Man came, maybe the least known, maybe the least expected, the Son of Man came eating and drinking, Matthew says. Can we name like one of these things is not like the others? Right? Like, the Son of Man came to seek and save the lost. Okay, check. Yeah, that makes sense. Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve. Yeah, okay, absolutely, makes sense. Son of Man came to destroy all of the untrue things in the world, to undo the work of the devil. Yeah, absolutely. Son of Man came eating and drinking. to me, this feels like one of these is not like the others. Like, Matthew, why is that such a big deal that you would put this out there and say, like, this is one of the reasons Jesus came? And Matthew will actually argue that Jesus did this so often, he actually got a reputation for it. It's what Matthew says next in this same sentence. It says, the Son of Man came eating and drinking, and they say, here is a glutton and a drunkard, a friend of tax collectors and sinners. To Matthew, eating and drinking is something Jesus apparently did enough that it earned him a reputation in the community. So why, what is going on with that? Why, when Matthew's thinking of all the things he could say that like Jesus came into the world to do, why does he name eating and drinking as one of the top priorities, as one of the very top things? And then it feels like the other gospel authors, even though they might not say it, it feels like they agree, because as we read the stories of Jesus, we see Jesus doing this all the time. Mark actually doesn't waste a whole lot of time getting there. Mark already in Mark chapter 2 has a story of Jesus sitting down for a meal to eating and drinking with a group of people. And this becomes controversial and scandalous right off the bat in Mark chapter 2. And so I want to look at that story as we ask the question, why would Matthew say this is such a big deal? So Mark chapter 2, we're going to start at verse 13. It says, once again, Jesus went out beside the lake. Now, the lake is the Sea of Galilee. Goes up beside the Sea of Galilee. A large crowd came to him, and he began to teach them. As he walked along, he saw Levi, son of Alphaeus, sitting at the tax collector's booth. Now, pause. Story's going to be about Jesus and Levi. Levi is later going to have his name changed. Anybody know what Levi's name becomes? Matthew. So when we're reading Levi, I'll be reading it as Levi because the story describes him as Levi, but also think this is the same guy who's going to write the first of our gospels. So this is the same guy. Levi is Matthew. So once Jesus went out beside the lake, a large crowd came to him, and he began to teach them. As he walked along, he saw Levi, son of Alphaeus, sitting at the tax collector's booth. Follow me, Jesus told him, and Levi got up and followed him. While Jesus was having dinner at Levi's house, many tax collectors and sinners were eating with him and his disciples, for there were many who followed him. When the teachers of the law, who were Pharisees, saw him eating with the sinners and tax collectors, they asked his disciples, why does he eat with tax collectors and sinners? Mark chapter 2, Jesus kind of gets himself in hot water because of who he's sitting down at a meal with. So let's jump into the story. So already in the story, we see that we have like two groups of people who disagree with each other. We have this religious group, we're told they're the teachers of the law, who were Pharisees. And then we have this group of people that we're told are these tax collectors and sinners. So what is going on? Who are these groups? What is their worldview? Why? What is coming to clash in this space? And to explain that, I want to start by looking at a map just to set the scene. So if we go to a map of Israel, so laser pointer, just a little forewarning, I'm going to use this a lot today. We're going to have fun. So this is the nation of Israel. We've got the Sea of Galilee, Jordan River, down to the Dead Sea. We already know in our story we're in what region of Israel? The north. We're by the lake. We're by the Sea of Galilee. So if we zoom in on the Sea of Galilee, we know this story is going to take place on the northwest shore. There are three cities that are significant on the northwest side of the Sea of Galilee. Chorazin, good religious Jewish village. It's really not referenced in your Bibles, but it's a good religious Jewish village. We have Bethsaida. We have a number of disciples are going to come from Bethsaida. They call Bethsaida home. It's a small fishing village. Actually means house of hunting, house of fishing. Philip, Andrew, James, John, they all come out of Bethsaida. And then we have Capernaum. Capernaum is the spot where Jesus is going to live during his adult ministry. So Jesus is going to kind of live as an adult right here in Capernaum. This, as you kind of see a shape between these three villages, right? Looks like a triangle. We call this the religious triangle. It's where your Pharisees are mostly going to be up in this region. Jesus in our Gospels is going to do about 80% of his ministry is going to happen in kind of this region among those kind of like religious Jewish communities. So this is the religious triangle. Pharisees are present in our story. Of course the Pharisees are present in the story. This is where they live. This is home base, which then begs the question, what is Levi doing there? Levi, we learn his occupation. Levi is a tax collector. Why is Levi in the religious triangle, in the area of the good religious Jewish villages? Why is he there? And in order to understand that, we need to understand a little bit more of their world and what Levi, what Matthew did. See, during their world, our Christmas story. So when Jesus is born, the entire region is ruled by one guy. He oversees the entire territory. Just a hint, his name, it starts with an H and it ends with Herod the Great. Herod the Great rules the entirety of it. Herod the Great will die. Herod the Great's kingdom, it's a longer, really interesting story. His kingdom, at least in this region, will be divided amongst three of his kids. One of his kids will get the territory a little bit further south. This area is going to be split between two of his other kids. If we go to the next map, everything in red, I gave you a key. You're welcome. So everything in red is ruled by a guy by the name of Herod Antipas. When Jesus, as an adult in his ministry, runs into Herod, it's Herod Antipas. So Antipas is in this region. This region is ruled by Antipas's brother, a guy by the name of Philip the Tetrarch. Now remember, what does Levi do? Levi's a tax collector. Any guesses, if you're wrong, and you need to support your military, you need to grow your empire, what might you decide to do when people cross from one territory to another that might make a tax collector really helpful? Right, I'm gonna drive to Florida in a couple weeks and we're gonna have to go through a number of toll booths, right? Like, you're leaving this area, you're going here, you have to pay money. This is kind of how it worked in the ancient world. You go from one territory to another, you have to pay a tax. It makes sense that Levi, a tax collector, would be there. And then if we put one more layer on this, if we put a road, there was like their world's M6, right? It's the first century. This is the busiest road in the world. This is like the road that connected all of the empires. It's called the Via Maris. It means way of the sea. If we backed up, it runs along the Mediterranean. It is going to connect all of the who's who in the ancient world. Where does it run right through? Capernaum. Levi is stationed in Capernaum. Levi, we know the story. This story happens in the city of Capernaum. Why? Because Levi recognizes there is all kinds of money to be made in Capernaum. He can tax the people who are going from the area of Philip the Tetrarch to Antipas or back. He's right on the major highway. So all of the trade that is coming through that major highway, Levi is able to collect taxes from all of it. So a question, if Levi's in Capernaum, in the religious triangle, do the religious leaders, do the Pharisees know who this guy is? Absolutely, they know who this guy is. It's probable Levi has actually taken money from them. It's likely all of the religious leaders, they know exactly who this guy is. And so to the religious leaders, to the Pharisees, one of their jobs was... The Pharisees were all about the strict observance of the rules, the laws that are in our Torah, the first five books of the Bible. There are 613 laws. The Pharisees were all about obedience to all of them. The Pharisees literally kind of created a system that determined who was in and who then was out. To a Pharisee, is a tax collector in or out? Out. Right, a tax collector, they are not one of us. They are on the outside. They absolutely know who Levi is in Capernaum when Jesus has this encounter with the tax collector. And then there's a question about that group, right? Mark kind of talks as though like the tax collectors are just kind of like lumped into this, tax collectors and sinners. Often when we read our Gospels, we kind of read these two groups of people almost as if they're one and the same. So what does Mark mean by tax collector and sinner? Well, first, a tax collector. Who was a tax collector? Well, the tax collectors were largely one of their own people. So somebody who grew up, you are ethnically Jewish, you maybe even grow up in the same village, but at some point the tax collector looked at the power of Rome and essentially said, "What? We're not going to be able to fight back. Look how big they are. Look how small we are. Look how powerful they are." And what they recognized is there was a way to get ahead by essentially partnering up with Rome to help tax their own people. So to your good religious Jewish leaders, to the communities in that religious triangle, the tax collectors are part of the problem. They were one of us. And yet instead of fighting with us, they decided to partner up to cozy up with Rome and then make life that much harder on us. Tax collectors. Then that word sinner. The word sinner in their world, like, yes, it means people who sinned, but it also became like a larger social bucket that they could kind of put the people in who they said were out, who they said did not belong. And so for them, tax collectors and sinners, yeah, they are social outcasts. They are on the outside. You do not go to them. And so when Jesus shows up and he goes and he sits down and has a meal with the tax collectors and sinners, Jesus is making a statement. Jesus is going to the people that the institution said are the untouched. They're on the outside. You do not go to them. And what Jesus knew is that in his world, actually sitting down and having a meal was more than just sharing food in the same space. But to sit down and share a meal with somebody was making a statement. Because in their world, to sit down and share a meal was to show a level of social acceptance, to show Jesus sitting down and having a meal with a tax collector and sinner, showed that Jesus was willing to put his reputation on the line, especially within the religious community, in order for guys like Levi and his peers to know that they belonged. That for his community, Jesus is going to absolutely put his reputation on the line to sit down with tax collectors and sinners. What's the community going to say of him? He's one of them by association, right? Jesus is willing to put all of that on the line to sit down at a table with somebody that he was told did not belong. See, in their world, they recognize that something happens around a table, that a dining table, that a meal shared together is almost becomes like a holy space. I think we get this. So I took a picture of, this is my dining room table. I took a picture of it yesterday. I, don't worry, last night, like I cleared the picture by my wife to make sure like I had everything out of the way enough in the shot, right? But this is my dining room table. As you think about your dining room table, think about the things that happened around your table. Think about the life that you've shared around your table. This is a space, yes, this is a space where I sit down and I've shared meals with my family, with my friends. This is a space where I help my kids with their homework. This is a space where I've been able to enter into other people's stories. That there's something special about a dining room table that in the midst of all of the busyness of life, all of the things you've got to do and places you've got to be, the dining table, that space, almost becomes an opportunity where you just get to sit down and be present with the people that you're sharing the space with. To the leaders during Jesus' day, they recognized sitting down at a table with somebody and sharing a meal is more than just eating in the same space. It means something. They would actually later, kind of a couple centuries after the time of Jesus, they would actually kind of solidify almost a theology around the table, like the dining table, in a writing called the Talmud. Now, the Talmud is it's a Jewish collection of writings that kind of serves as a commentary or notes on our Old Testament text. And they saw there was a verse in the Old Testament that they saw kind of develop a theology around what happens around a table. It's all the way back. It's a prophet that we know by the name of Ezekiel. I want to show the verse for Ezekiel, but before we read it, Ezekiel's a prophet who's speaking to the Jewish people, to the Israelite people, after they've been brought into exile. So they have been removed from the temple. And Ezekiel has this vision. He says this. He says, there was a wooden altar 3 cubits high, 2 cubits square. Its corners, its base, and its sides were of wood. The man in his vision said to me, "This is the table that is before the Lord." What they recognized is there were two objects that were connected in Ezekiel's vision. Do you see them? The altar, they said, became a table. What the leaders looked at is they said, okay, Ezekiel, so what is the altar? Well, the altar would have been the place in the temple where you would essentially go and meet with God. It's where God meets with his people. It's where you get reconciled to God. It's where you have an opportunity to be reconciled to one another. And what they recognize in Ezekiel, there's this link between the altar and the table, so much so that in the Talmud, a couple centuries later, they would write this. If you want to check it, it's in Chakiga. I have no idea how to say the reference to that. So what they said in the Talmud is, when the temple is standing, the altar atones for a person. But now that the temple has been destroyed, they're writing after Rome has come in and wiped out the temple, now that the temple has been destroyed, it is a person's table that atones for him. They said there's something that happens at the table, so much so that they almost came to recognize that it's almost like the table is a form of altar. That the table is an opportunity where you're able to step out of the normal, all of the busyness of life, where you're able to sit down and be present to God in this space, be present to one another, that there's something almost sacred and holy that happens around a table. And again, I think we get this, because as I think about my table, like, this is a space where I've been able to gather with like my family and friends. We've sat around this table. I've laughed with people around this table. I've cried at this table. If I think about the times that I've been like maybe the most vulnerable in my life, it's happened at this table. Like, there is something, they said, happens around the table. And that is why the religious leaders are freaking out that Jesus would dare invite a tax collector and a sinner into that space with him. They are on the outside. They are not right. They don't belong here. And yet Jesus does it time and again. So much so that when Matthew would name that the Son of Man came eating and drinking, it almost feels like if we step back and look at those other statements, right? The Son of Man came to seek and save the lost. The Son of Man came to destroy the devil's work. The Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom. Feels like those kind of answer that, like, what did Jesus come to do? And in a lot of ways, this feels like it answers the, like, okay, but how did he do it? Or like, how did he seek and save the lost? Well, so often it was by sitting down at a table and sharing a meal. How did Jesus speak truth into the midst of the lies to bring life into the midst of the darkness? So often it was by sitting down and sharing with a meal with the people around him. And it's not lost on me. Of the Gospels, which one is the one that wrote these words? Guy by the name of Matthew. Matthew's name had been. It's not lost on me that the guy who writes this is the guy who literally had his life changed because Jesus would go out of his way to put his reputation on the line to have a meal with him. Levi, Matthew's life was changed because he was invited into a space that everybody else said he did not belong in. Jesus flipped his life upside down around a table. If Jesus makes space for Levi, shows that the invitation is for anyone, for everyone, that Jesus invites all people in. And if Levi kind of starts to show that welcome, there's another table that I think shows us just how wide that invitation goes. And so I want to leave this first table and then jump to a second table. We'll look at a second table together. Is it okay if we look at one more table? This one, I remember the first time like I understood what we get to look at for the next like 10, 15 minutes, just like blew my mind. This is a table that's going to come later. It's a table. It's words that we're pretty familiar with. We read them often, especially around like communion and the Lord's Supper. It is this last supper that Jesus is going to have with his disciples. It's on the night he's going to be betrayed. He's going to be arrested. He will be killed. We'll look at those stories as we get a little bit closer to Easter in the next couple weeks. But Jesus is going to sit down for a meal. I want to read it, and then we're going to step back and we're going to kind of unpack it. So when evening came, Jesus arrived with the 12. While they were reclining at the table eating, he said, "Truly I tell you, one of you will betray me, one who is eating with me." They were saddened, and one by one they said to him, "Surely you don't mean me." "It is one of the 12," he replied, "one who dips bread into the bowl with me. The Son of Man will go just as it is written about him. But woe to the man who betrays the Son of Man. It would be better for him if he had not been born." While they were eating, Jesus took bread, and when he had given thanks, he broke it and gave it to his disciples, saying, "Take it, this is my body." Then he took a cup, and when he had given thanks, he gave it to them, and they all drank from it. "This is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many," he said to them. "Truly I tell you, I will not drink again from the fruit of the vine until the day when I drink it new in the kingdom of God." When they had sung a hymn, they went out to the Mount of Olives. Again, Jesus' Last Supper. And so what I want to do this morning is I actually want to like put us into the story, to give us a mental image of the story, because I think the image that many of us have is pretty wrong. I think the image that most of us have of this story actually comes from much later art. Da Vinci's Lord's Supper. How many of you, like, you think of this story like you think of that painting? Jesus in the middle, you have all of the disciples, they're all at this table. So much is historically wrong in this photo, to the point that, can you imagine, you walk into a restaurant and you're like, "Hey, we need a table for 26. Like, but you only have 13 of you. And you're like, "Oh, but we're all gonna sit on the same side. Like, who sits on the same side of the table? What are we doing?" Jesus is in the center, they're all sitting on the same side, they're sharing this meal. This is not how the Last Supper would have looked. Purge this image from your memory. Now what I want to do is I want to try to replace it with something more historically accurate. Instead of one long, big banquet table, Jesus and the disciples would have sat around a table that would have looked like this. It's called a triclinium. Triclinium has three sides. You would sit around the outside. The middle of it's open so that whoever's serving the meal can kind of enter into that middle space and serve onto the table. You would be around the outside of the table, and you would share, there'd be kind of like shared bowls on the table that you would share with the people next to you. You would take bread, you would dip it into the bowls, you would eat with those right next to you. And you would not sit as like you're sitting right now, as the disciples and Jesus are sitting in Da Vinci. You aren't on a chair pulled up to the table. Mark actually, like, he gives us a clue as to how you would sit. It's right at the beginning. It says, while they were reclining. Now, I think reclining, like you think Lazy Boy, right? You think like feet kicked up, they're reclining back. Not how they would have done it. If we go back to triclinium, this table wouldn't have had chairs around it. It would have had like cushions or pillows. And what you would do is to recline means you would essentially lay on your left side. The whole like sanitary things will come into play much, much later. So in their world, you had a left hand that you do unclean things with. And everybody said, yuck. You don't use your left hand to eat. You lay on your left side, left hip, left elbow. You then have your right hand free to eat. Does this make sense? So if we go to my next image, I drew stick figures on the table. You're welcome. Stick figures. So if we're all laying on the left side, pay attention to what direction you're facing. I promise this will like pay off later. So if you're here and everybody is laying, think, on their left side using their right hand, which direction are you facing in the photo? Down, right? Do you see this? Because they're all laying on their left side. If you're on the top and you're laying on your left side, you're facing this direction. Make sense? So if you're down here and you're laying on your left side, you're facing up. Can everybody kind of see that? So can you see how even like if we back up just a little bit, right before they actually eat this meal, Jesus is going to walk around. He's going to wash his disciples' feet. Do you see how even just knowing how the triclinium is set up helps give a better image for that? Like, Jesus isn't crawling around under a table, like untying people's shoes. When you're laying like this, your feet are exposed all the way around the outside. You just make your way around the perimeter and you wash the people's feet around the table. Do you see how that, like, it's way less weird this way? It's still weird, but it's way less weird. But, so this is the triclinium. The best picture I could find is kind of a not great watercolor image of kind of what it kind of would have looked like. So you have shared bowls, you're around the outside, you serve from the center. So if we go back to our triclinium, you'll notice I have like a few of the seats, these boxes I have colored. Some of the boxes were different than the others. There were a few kind of designated spots where people would sit. If you have a Mark devotional, go to page 195. We actually have this diagram on page 195. If you don't have a Mark devotional, it's not too late. They are just outside, the doors around the corner. But on page 195, you'll have this next picture, which will show you kind of where the designated seats are. So in our meal, you have the host of the meal is gonna sit right here. That's kind of the most important person. That's the one that's kind of like putting the meal on. That's your host. You have right behind them is a guest of honor. Right in front of them, a trusted friend. And then over here is the servant. It might be the servant's job to like help serve in the triclinium, to help serve the meal. It would often be the servant's job to like wash people's feet as they go around. That's the servant. So I want to play a game with you. As a kid, like I was one of those kids with the little magnifying glass and like I pretend I'm this little detective, right? Like I want to play like a detective game with you for the next little bit. Let's call it Who Sat Where? As we try to decipher, so what we're going to do is we're going to look at a few different kind of passages and we're going to try to like, you know, with their like little orphan Annie secret decoder ring, like we're going to try to figure out what are the clues and who then is sitting where at the table. So if we start, easy Sunday school answer, at the Last Supper, who's the host? Jesus, well done, you crushed it. Jesus is the host. Jesus is the one putting it on. You recognize already, Da Vinci, where does Da Vinci put Jesus? Right in the middle of the banquet table. That's not where the host is in a triclinium. Host is second in from the left, right here. This is the spot where Jesus is. So then, where is everybody else? And already, like, it's gonna be hard to know who's in some of these other seats, but at least who's in the prominent seats. And in order to see that, I wanna jump from Mark to John, one of Jesus' other disciples, John's account. John is gonna say this. It says, one of them, the disciple whom Jesus loved, and pause already real quick, the one Jesus loved, this is like John's kind of strange way of talking about himself. So when John talks about the disciple Jesus loved, John's like, hey guys, that's me. If you keep reading, like John weirdly later wants you to know that he can also beat Peter in a foot race. It's weird, but it's there. But so the one Jesus loved, John's talking about himself. So one of them, the disciple whom Jesus loved, John, was reclining next to him. Simon Peter motioned to this disciple and said, ask him which one he means. Leaning back against Jesus, he asked him, Lord, who is it? Do you see any clues? My super sleuths. What's a clue? Leaning back. And then in the Greek, it actually says leaning back against Jesus' chest. So if we go to the triclinium, if Jesus is here, if everybody is laying on their left side, who is the one person who can lean back into Jesus' chest? What seat are they in? Trusted friend. John is probably... Do we know for certain, like there was no like Ring doorbell camera that like captured, was John probably in that seat? I would say at least from the way John tells the story, yeah, John is in the seat. And it makes sense. Like John and Jesus have always had this kind of special relationship, right? It's only gonna be a few days later when Jesus is at the cross. Jesus is actually gonna have that moment between John and his mother Mary, like John, this is your mom. Mom, this is your son. Like, it makes sense that John would be in that space. So, okay, so we've got Jesus, we've got John. Now, there's one more clue, I think, in that John passage, if we put it back up. Let's see if you can find, oh, I Can anybody find the second clue? So Simon Peter was able to motion to John. Okay, so Peter somehow did something to get John's attention to ask Jesus which disciple was going to betray him. So if we go back to the triclinium, this is where our directions are going to matter. If we go to that next slide of the triclinium, boo, 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 boo. Okay, page 195 in your devotional. If you look at the triclinium, if everybody on the left side is faith, does everybody have a picture? So if John is on the bottom left facing down, and everybody on the right side is facing up, which seat probably has the best view to be able to get John's attention? The seat of the servant, right? Again, do we know with 100% certainty? No, we can't. But I would argue Peter is almost surely in the spot of the servant directly across. They're facing different directions, but because they're right across from each other, it makes sense he's able to get John's attention. Hey, ask him who he's talking about. Peter's probably in the spot of the servant, which I think also makes sense because remember, who's going to go around and wash everybody's feet? Jesus, the host. That's not the job of the host. That's the job of the servant. The disciples all like object when Jesus goes to wash their feet. We're told one disciple especially objects. Any guesses who it is? Peter. It makes me wonder. Is Peter like wrestling with like, why would Jesus put me in the role of the servant? Right? Because one of the roles of the host is the host determines where everybody else sits. It's not just a first come, first serve. It's not random. Host determines where everybody sits. Is Peter wondering, like, why would Jesus put me here? Is Peter thinking that role is beneath him? And then he sees Jesus show him what his kingdom actually looks like in the host. The one putting on the meal is the one who actually goes around and washes all of the disciples' feet. I would argue Peter is almost surely in the seat of the servant. Then, if we go to the book, is it going to come back on just in time? Okay, in Mark. Oh, yes, let's go. So we got John, we've got Peter. Now, if we jump back into Mark's telling of it, Mark is going to give a detail that I think is also then going to be helpful. If we jump into, while they were reclining at the table eating, Jesus said, truly I tell you, one of you will betray me, one who is eating with me. They were saddened, and one by one they said to him, surely you don't mean me. It is one of the 12, he replied, one who dips bread into the bowl with me. Do you see a clue? One who dips bread into the bowl with me. If we go back to the triclinium, if we're eating with a shared bowl, right? You take some bread, you're dipping into a shared bowl. If Jesus is here, it makes sense that this seat could share a bowl with Jesus, right? But we already have that seat taken. John's in that seat. Who's in the guest of honor? Judas. Again, do we know for sure? No. But do I think we can decipher from the story? Absolutely. I think Jesus, when he sat down at the Last Supper, Jesus sitting in the role of host gets to put everybody else where they belong. Jesus puts Judas right next to him in the seat of the guest of honor. Why? Well, I wonder if part of the answer is because Jesus knows that at some point in the next few days, it's going to become clear to the rest of the disciples, like, who's the one that did it, right? Who's the one that betrayed him? And they'll think back to this meal. Once they figure it out, they'll think back to this meal. And if Judas is just sitting up here, it's easy to think, oh, well, he was just there because he was with us and he was one of us. But, like, he was always, like, he was doing his own thing. But the fact that Jesus put him right here means if you're a disciple and you think back to this meal, you can't wonder whether or not Jesus was okay with Judas even being there. Judas gave him the spot of the guest of honor. the guy, knowing everything he was going to do, Jesus made space, didn't just made space, he gave the best space to the one who was going to leave that meal and betray him later that night. Because isn't that just what Jesus does? Right? Isn't that just who Jesus is? That if it's Levi and going to the tax collectors and sinners, those who have made a bunch of decisions, who have compromised, and Jesus goes to them knowing his reputation is on the line, knowing he's going to get a reputation, Jesus says they're still worth it, and he makes space for them. And then Jesus, on the very night he'll be betrayed, he gathers together and he not only gives a space, he gives the best space for the guy that was about to do it, because Jesus says, you also matter. I find these Jesus kind of table theology, Jesus inviting all people into this space, so incredibly helpful, because I do think for some of us, we've been told at some point in our lives, we've been told that you don't belong or that you don't measure up or that you're not enough. You've been told by some community that because of something, maybe something you've done, a decision you made, maybe something that's happened to you, and you've either been told you're on the outside or they've not said it, but it's been pretty obvious in the way they've treated you. These stories show that regardless, Jesus creates a space. If he's going to create a space for Levi and a space for Judas, there's a space for any and every one of us. And then there's the question of how do we use our spaces, right? How do we use our tables? How do we use those spaces in our lives? And can we as the church make sure that there's always an open seat at the table for one more person, one more life, one more Levi who gets an opportunity to come in, meet Jesus, and see their life change forever because of it? Would you pray with me? God, we thank you for these stories, for the way these stories tell us something true about who you are, about who we are, about how you view us. That you are a God who came here to us. As Paul said, while we were still sinners, Jesus, you died for us. It wasn't that we got ourselves cleaned up, that we got our stories put back straight, but that in the midst of our worst, you still gave your life for us because you love us, your children, that much. So God, may that truth push out all of the lies of the other things that we might tell ourselves in our own heads. May we cling to that knowledge and that truth. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.
For more information about how you can become a part of the South Harbor Church community, find us on the web at www.southharbor.org or find us on Facebook and Instagram at South Harbor Church. And on Sunday mornings, you can find our service streamed live at 8:45 a.m. on Facebook and YouTube. And so from all of us here at South Harbor Church and the Harbor Churches, we want to wish you a blessed week.